You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when you've already covered 750 miles of the South Pole on skis and ridden your bike across the entire country, you got to be creative when thinking up new adventures. We hear from an adventurer who just completed a nine-day journey in his home state to explore 500 miles of Wisconsin by bike, foot, and kayak. First, there's an overlooked challenge facing schools around Wisconsin and nationwide: student turnover. A large number of kids switch from one school to another from year to year or even during a school year. That can cause difficulties for the kids and the learning environment. But there's not a lot of tracking done by states, and even when there is data, it can be hard to find, even harder to compare. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards is looking at the issue of student churn in an ongoing investigative report. Aaron, good to have you back with us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Also with us is Bernadette Thompson. She's a grandmother who switched her grandson into a new school this year in the Milwaukee public school system. Bernadette, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Not a problem. It is my joy.
And Aaron, let's start with you. In the second installment in your series, you look at why it's so hard to keep track of student turnover. A lot of places don't keep data on this.
Yeah, we found that when we surveyed all 50 states, we found about half of state education departments don't even track or at least publicly report the rates of students who churn through certain schools. And that can make it really hard to compare. You know, if you've got two low performing schools and one has a lot of kids coming in and out the door and the other one's pretty stable, you might want to look at those schools differently if you're looking at different reforms or different things to provide them with to improve. So we just found that, you know, this issue is hard to track because kids move and you have to have data systems that are sophisticated enough to follow them. But what we found is that just a lot of people don't even define movement, mid-year moves or moving over the summer in the same way. So a lot of kids just aren't tracked. And as a result, a lot of people don't know very much about this issue.
That's interesting. This is a problem where the cause is it's not anybody doing anything wrong. It's parents making rational decisions. It's schools doing the best they can, right? There's not like a bad guy in some ways.
No, there's really nobody to point the finger at. And as Bernadette will explain later, you know, parents switch their kids into new schools for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes it's economic instability and people are reacting because they don't like a school or they don't like people at a school. But sometimes people need to make a new choice or need to make a switch for other reasons. Maybe someone got a new job or they're moving to a new city. And the problem is, a switch looks like a switch unless you dig into the reasons why that switch is happening. And most importantly, what kind of supports are there for parents and new kids coming into schools, and what supports are there for teachers and staff who are often getting a lot of new kids all at once?
Let's turn to Bernadette Thompson now. She's a grandmother who switched her grandson into a new school in the Milwaukee system. Bernadette, tell us how you came to be looking for a place, a school, to put your grandson, Drayden, into.
Well, I'm going to tell you, it was a last-minute decision. My daughter had a job transfer to Phoenix, Arizona. And during this time, she was trying to find residency, which is kind of hard because she's coming from one state to the other. So as time moved on and the school year was starting to start, I'm like, what you going to do? What you going to do? And she said, Mom, I don't have nowhere to stay. So it was like that Thursday before school started, I called up to Mapletree because my grandson, who's 21 years, he went there when we first moved over here in this area. And he went there to kindergarten and first grade. So I said, well, it's right around the corner. It's 5 minutes away from the house. I'll try there. So when I called up to the school, they said, well, because your situation is so different, you have to go down to the school board. So I ran down to the school board, and I explained my situation, and they were so helpful. I mean, when I walked out of there, I was just thanking God. And so to make sure that he was registered, I went to the school, and they had him in the computer, and I was going to see if there was any paperwork or anything that I needed before he started, like, that Tuesday. So, you know, it all really worked out for me, but it was something that took place within a matter of a few days that I had to take him from. He was going to school at Blessed Savior, and when I had called them, they said they didn't have any room available. So now I had to really get, you know, put my sneakers on and start, you know, getting ready to get him into the school year because time was of the essence.
Well, you got it. You made it happen. And now how is it for Drayden? He's like a lot of kids are finding out he went from one school to another school in a new school year. What's that like for him with friends, new teachers, new principals, all that?
Well, you know what? A lot of times we as parents, you know, when we have to drop our kids off, you know, we have our pajamas on and we drop them off and go. For some odd reason that morning, they said, put your clothes on. And at the time I went, I didn't realize that they were having this big celebration. You know, everybody from the school board came down. They had a band and stuff. It was exciting. It was exciting for him. And, you know, everybody was neat and greeting. And, you know, he got to meet his teacher. Everybody was so helpful. And he was very elated. So when he went to stand with his school, I mean his grade, a few guys, a young men were there. And so I was walking around, you know, seeing what was going on. And then there were some people there that I knew. And when I walked back, he said, Grandma, I already made a new friend. This is my friend. You know, and he was just elated. And I was glad to see that because I came from Chicago. And when we moved here, we couldn't get into parochial school, so I had to go to a public school, which I had attended parochial school all my life. So it was devastating, especially coming to a whole new city, not knowing anybody. So I wanted to be there to support him, to let him know it was all right, this is new, it's exciting. They had so much to offer for the kids. And he was there, and he was elated to know that he can have sports and go here. I can't say enough for everything that the school had introduced to me that was offered to him.
That's great. So Bernadette, before I let you go, it sounds like the school really made an effort when they have this new kid, or I assume a bunch of new kids coming in, they make an effort to welcome them.
They did, because when I explained to them my situation, they said, don't worry, Ms. Thompson. We have it. You know, I gave him my name. I told him to call me 24 hours a day. And, you know, whenever I go up there, they're very kind. They know who I am. Very helpful. And, I mean, when you feel like it's part of a home, it just makes it easy for you as a parent to be supportive of the kid because you have the support of the school.
Well, Bernadette, thanks for sharing your story, and good luck to Drayden in this school year.
Okay, and thank you so much for calling.
So, Erin, Bernadette tells a pretty happy story. The school that her grandson went to, Maple Tree School, she says is doing a lot to welcome new kids. That's not universal. Not every school has this on their radar, right?
No, and as a matter of fact, Bernadette and Drayden really lucked out because they entered Maple Tree, which just happened to be the school that was chosen as the celebration site for the first day of school. So the state superintendent was there, and marching bands were there, and people were cheering, and there was a red carpet, and there was all of this celebration that they just got lucky. They got into a school where there was this sort of welcoming party for everyone, and Drayden flowed right into that crowd. And I think that Bernadette's experience, you know, as she says, puts on her sneakers and runs to central office to make sure that her child is enrolled. This is a grandparent who cares deeply about her child, and there's lots of other parents in this city that do too. But I've been hanging out with other moms and dads who can't get to central office right away, or they just don't have the capacity to make sure all those T's are crossed and I's are dotted, and then they just kind of get lost in the system, and their kids do too, and they end up switching to some new place and nobody has a record of where they've been or what they've done so far. So I feel like Bernadette and Drayden really represent, you know, the way that this can work out really well for good reasons, but not everybody else is so lucky.
And as you were saying earlier, not every school, not every district, not every state is tracking this issue of school turnover, school churn as an issue. So kids really might be off the radar.
Yeah. And even Wisconsin, which has gotten more attuned to this issue, they're now releasing the mobility rates for districts on these annual report cards that schools and districts get. But they don't have any plans to release rates that are school by school. And around the state right now, in part because of this series, a lot of folks are saying, well, you know, how we're in Green Bay, what is our mobility rate and what is it in each school? And, you know, we've provided that data, but it took us a year to figure it out. So I would hope that as a result of this, more, if not, you know, full-blown state education departments, then at least more individual districts will start to define this in a more uniform way and start to track where these kids are going.
As you told us last week, the Milwaukee average student turnover rate 25%. That's considerably higher than the state as a whole. And some schools even higher. Maple Tree, for example, a 36% student turnover rate. Are you seeing awareness in these high turnover schools and districts that, hey, we have to do something. We have to do a little extra when we have this high turnover to get these new kids on board and make the educational experience work for the kids who are staying here too?
Well, I hope that's where it's going. I haven't actually received a lot of response yet from Milwaukee Public Schools. They have some of their own internal metrics on this. And I've heard from individual teachers who are saying, holy smokes, we can see that our kids are coming and going, but we don't have data on where they're going to or where they're coming to us from. And I know one high school teacher who said, I'd really like to know how, the scores of these kids who stay versus the ones who are just in and out and with us for a short time. And the data system, either the data system or the rules regarding how they use the data system in Milwaukee Public Schools won't allow him to look at that data at a granular level as a teacher. So that was kind of frustrating for him.
Right. And to wrap up, as you look at different states, even when they track a student turnover, they might define it in a different way. So you can't do an apples to apples comparison from one state to the next. Would you like to see some kind of national standard or states agree on a common standard so we can have a national picture of this?
I certainly think it would be helpful. A similar but different issue is chronic absenteeism, which is a really wonky way of just saying, you didn't come to school. And they've started to define that as missing nationally. We've started to understand that as missing more than 15 days of the school year means that you're chronically absent. And so if we can come to sort of a general agreement about what that looks like, I think we could generally say, okay, between this fall goalpost and this spring goalpost, if you move around between that, you're a mobile kid. And this is how we're going to track it as a nation.
Erin, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks a lot.
Erin Richards is an education reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The second article in her series on school turnover is linked at WPR.org. We also talked to Bernadette Thompson, a grandmother who switched her grandson into a new school this year in Milwaukee Public Schools. Erin is going to be with us at this time next week for more on the story, and you can weigh in on the Ideas Network comment line at 833-42-IDEAS. We want to hear about your experiences with student turnover. If you're a parent, have you had to move your child around to different schools? What's that been like for you and for them? If you're a teacher or an administrator, is this an issue in your classroom, your school, your district? How does it affect your work and your students' ability to learn? Leave a message at 833-42-IDEAS. That's 833-424-3327 and let us know. If you've already completed an expedition to both the North and South Poles, are one of the few Americans to have skied to both the poles as well and summited Mount Everest, what do you do next? Well, you go to Wisconsin, of course. Maybe not as frigid or quite as dangerous, but Wisconsin has some appeal to adventurers. Our next guest grew up in Wisconsin and returned to complete what he's called the Wisconsin-thon, a 500-mile border-to-border journey by foot, bike, and kayak. Eric Larson is a polar adventurer, expedition guide, dog musher, and educator. He spent the past 15 years traveling in some of the most remote and wild places on Earth, and he's returned to his home state for this 9-day, 500-mile journey, which he completed yesterday. Eric, welcome to Central Time. Eric, are you there? We just had him on the studio link to Milwaukee. Eric, I think we have you now. Are you there?
I am.
Fantastic. Now, you grew up in Wisconsin. You've been to both the poles. You've done all this adventurous stuff. What led you to say, hey, I'm going to go back to my home state and make my way from one border to the other?
Well, I think a big part of my expeditions are about talking about bigger ideas, and I wanted to have a conversation with people about the fact that adventure is really everywhere, and you don't have to go to these extreme places to find unique and compelling adventures.
Right. Yeah, I'm probably never going to go to a pole, I'll be honest with you. But for those of us in my less adventurous frame of mind, how can we chart out an adventure in our backyard or our home state?
I mean, there's a million things that you can do basically anywhere, and it just takes a little bit of creativity or extra thought or planning or quite honestly, not a lot of planning whatsoever. I mean, Wisconsin has a lot of state parks, a lot of natural areas. There's a lot of opportunities to get outside. And I think people just need a little bit of a reminder that, hey, there are some pretty unique opportunities right in your own backyard. And that's, again, really what this trip was all about.
Let's talk about your route and logistics traversing Wisconsin. You started on the Ice Age Trail in St. Croix in the northwest part of the state. You're on foot, then Rice Lake, you switched to bike, and then kayak from West Bend to Lake Michigan. Share some of the highlights of the trip.
Well, you know, each leg was kind of a unique journey for me. Growing up in Wisconsin, I've been all over the state, but still I managed to traverse some areas that I hadn't been. But, I mean, hiking on the Ice Age Trail was pretty incredible. Peak fall colors, leaves falling as I was hiking through, so many leaves on the ground that I couldn't even see the trail in certain areas. So that was pretty amazing. I think, you know, the middle of Wisconsin has some of the best road biking and road bike touring in the entire country. I mean, all the paved county highways and farm roads and just beautiful areas rolling through farm fields and kind of wood lots and small towns. Pretty amazing. Although I did run into some somewhat bad weather and snowstorms on the bike, which, you know, I shouldn't complain too much about snow, but I would say it's probably one of the more cold times that I've ever had. And then paddling right down the Milwaukee River into Milwaukee, you know, it's really interesting to be on the river and be surrounded by trees and hear 43, hear sirens or whatever in the background, but still be in this real isolated area. And then I have to say, paddling right through downtown Milwaukee was incredible.
And you were on your own for this trip, 9 days on your own. What is it like to have that kind of solitude without a lot of those easy everyday distractions we have around us?
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, I think that's the other really unique thing about adventure and getting outside. It gives you an opportunity to kind of disconnect from the hectic pace of our world that we're all in, that I'm in. And so being able to focus on one goal and one objective for an entire day and kind of let my thoughts wander, I think was a really incredible thing. Of course, there's times where I'm like, oh man, this is really hard and I don't want to be out here and I wish I was home. But, you know, you work through that and then it becomes very enjoyable.
Now, how does a Wisconsin kid end up being a polar explorer?
Well, I think the main requirement is growing up in Wisconsin. I mean, we don't have mountains, we don't have oceans, but we have some cold winters, or at least we used to. And so for me, I really got interested in doing outdoor adventure by just doing things like the Wisconsinathon in my backyard on Cedar Creek and the Milwaukee River. I was involved with River Edge Nature Center growing up in their summer camps and had some really kind of unique adventure experiences both there as well as with my family.
And this is full circle. You were kind of raising funds and awareness, right, for River Edge Nature Center.
Yeah, I have a basic motto. It's called have fun and do good. And so I like to do things that are interesting to me and fun, but I also want to try to give back in any way I can. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, adventure has given me a lot of really great gifts in life from my perspective and skills and knowledge that I've learned. And a big part of that was at River Edge. And so we're still actively raising money, trying to raise $5,000 to help others have the opportunity to go to River Edge Nature Center summer camps.
Does going to both the poles and Mount Everest and more, does it, when you come back to Wisconsin, do you look at it in a different way?
I mean, the thing about those trips is that I think you're pretty much the same person that before you left, but you're also just changed in ways that you can't even imagine. So I think for me, when I come back to Wisconsin, I feel a greater appreciation of where I'm from and my roots and the community in which I grew up.
Now, you just completed this trip literally yesterday, I think. Now you're working on a plan to head back to the South Pole next month. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, a goal with my adventures is to really push that leading edge. It's how can we do things in a more unique, more compelling, and oftentimes more challenging way. And so I have a solo expedition planned to the South Pole, where I'm hoping to set the speed record of a journey of around 700 miles to the South Pole.
And you're doing what, skiing, or how do you set that record?
Yeah, skiing and pulling a sled, and it's in the style that we call unsupported and unaided, and so I'm not receiving any outside assistance. I'll be pulling all my supplies in a sled with me, and I'm hoping that the journey will take between 21 and 23 days.
Wow. How do you set yourself up for that mentally and physically?
I mean, I stare at a white sheet of paper all day long. It's hard. You know, a big part of what I do on a trip like this is experience. You know, I've been doing polar expeditions now for almost 20 years. And so a lot of my preparation is based off of that. A lot of physical training is really important, which is part of one of the reasons, a smaller reason why I did this Wisconsin-thon trip. And then just planning and preparing all my gear, my food, going over all those lists and making sure that I have, you know, all my I's dotted and my T's crossed.
And leave us with a bit of inspiration, Erica, to take on an adventure, even if it isn't 20 plus days at the South Pole.
I mean, my philosophy is begin with one step. All you need to do is just take one step to get out there, and there's a lot of adventure waiting to be had.
It's a good place to leave it. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us in our Milwaukee studio today.
Thank you.
Eric Larson is a polar adventurer, expedition guide, dog musher, and educator. He returned to his home state, Wisconsin, for a 500-mile journey by foot, bike, and kayak, which he completed yesterday. You can learn more about his expeditions and read his blog at ericlarsonexplore.com. And that's Larson, L-A-R-S-E-N. President Trump is ratcheting up the attacks against Democrats while praising the actions he's taken since becoming president. That's nothing new for a president. What is different, though, is the amount of false claims he's been challenged on as we get closer and closer to Election Day. The Washington Post has called his recent attacks over the top and astonishing. One example, on Monday, the president tweeted that criminals and unknown Middle Easterners are mixed into the group of migrants that's moving toward the U.S. from Central America. When a CNN reporter pressed him about the claim the next day, Trump said he gets very good information from agents on the border and reiterated that assertion.
And I spoke to him literally last night. I spoke to another one this morning. Very good relationship with Border Patrol and ICE. And they say it happens all the time from the Middle East. It's not even saying bad or good, but some real bad ones. But if they intercept, well, they could very well be.
But there's no proof.
There's no proof of anything. There's no proof of anything, but they could very well be.
So what are we to believe when it comes to these kinds of statements, not just from President Trump, but other elected officials, candidates, surrogates, advocacy groups, and the like? And how should the media report on these statements? Jane Curley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota and director of the Silha Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, what do you think of the role of the media? There's debate, there's pushback from the public. When a politician makes a false statement, can a reporter call it a lie?
That's a magic word, isn't it? Because for many, many years, journalists took the view that if they called people liars, they were courting a libel suit, and they didn't want to do that. They also thought that calling something a lie was essentially an editorial conclusion that overrode their commitment to objectivity. But I think if you've got someone knowingly making a false statement of fact, that is a lie, and I think it should be called out as such.
Politicians play fast and loose with the truth sometimes. I think it's fair to say they exaggerate. Sometimes they outright lie. Is President Trump, was Canada Donald Trump, is President Trump something different? Is this something that the media hasn't really dealt with before?
Well, you're absolutely right that all politicians are given to hyperbole and to lack of precision, and that's part of our political discourse. But I do think that we have something else going on here. And I frankly don't know, because I'm not a psychologist. I don't know if this is an elaborate plan. I don't know if this is something that is being engineered by foreign powers. But what I do know is that we're seeing a volume of falsehoods coming from this president that I've certainly never experienced in my lifetime. I can't say what happened in the 18th century or the 19th century necessarily. But it isn't just a question of being imprecise or shading the truth. As your clip that you just played shows, the president makes statements for which he has no factual basis whatsoever and yet feels perfectly comfortable couching them in terms of phrases like, well, it may very well be, But that gets translated in many people's minds as a statement of fact, and it's simply not true.
Former White House Communications Director Anthony Scaramucci had a brief tempestuous span in the White House. He was on CNN this week and accused the president of being dishonest, something he said all politicians do. But he said Trump's falsehoods, not a big deal, mostly a sideshow.
We both know that he's telling lies. OK, so if you want me to say he's a liar, I'm happy to say he's a liar. But I'm telling you that those people that I wrote about in that book and the research that I did on it, on the levels of the weighted average of what they really care about, they care way less about that, John, and they care way more about, okay, we finally have a president that's my advocate. And so all of that other nonsense that he does, that existential nonsense, is less important to them.
So, Jane, that's a more or less supporter of the president saying he lies, but it's no big deal. So as the public watches it, as the media watches it, should we ignore that stuff and focus on the actual executive actions of the White House?
Well, I think it's possible to do more than one thing simultaneously. We have plenty of news media out there that are fully capable of doing both of these things. I just don't see how anybody in the electorate can have a sensible discussion about policy or about the causes that many people consider to be terribly important if they don't have a sound factual basis for doing that. If you don't have a factual basis, then it's all either wishful thinking or fantasy that is driving your decisions. And I think there's a segment of the population, and I'm not saying it's exclusively Trump supporters. There are probably other people that also operate this way who want to hear statements with which they agree that reaffirm their worldview. And if somebody will do that, then they'll be happy to follow them. If someone challenges that, they will push it away because it makes them feel uncomfortable, insecure, and basically disrupts their view of the world. I think one of the things I will tell my students, or if I'm out speaking to the public, is that it's incumbent upon all of us to challenge ourselves and to seek out sources of information that are reliable, but which don't necessarily agree with our preconceived notion. But increasingly today, it seems like people seek out the things that reaffirm what they already think is true and go from there with the assumption that, in fact, it is.
Talking to Jane Curley from the University of Minnesota, director of the Sulha Center for the Study of Media, Ethics, and Law, talking about the role of media in challenging inaccurate statements, lies from political figures, President Trump and others. Jane, we've seen this rise in these things called fact checkers, fact checking groups. Their whole job is to take statements from usually politicians, run them through, track them down, see if they're true or not, and then rate them true, false, or somewhere in between. There's a lot of this. Does it make any difference?
I don't know if it ultimately makes any difference if you're talking about the small percentage, I hope it's a small percentage of people, who really are not interested in having the way they view the world challenged. But if you're talking about people who would like to get to facts, I'm not going to say the truth because there probably isn't the truth out there, but we know that there are facts that are provable, and what I think many of these fact checkers are doing is testing that. Sometimes I know that some of the fact checkers, like the ones of the Washington Post, for example, will rate things on a sliding scale. They'll say something like mostly true, mostly false. And that's reality oftentimes because sometimes it's hard to get to the ultimate facts. And, of course, sometimes, again, politicians are speaking in a rhetorical way and they're maybe not intending to say that something is literally true or false. But it seems to me that there's a tremendous hunger out there for truth. The problem is that so many people have been conditioned now to believe that no one in the news media, whatever that means, is actually interested in giving them unvarnished facts but want to spin it. And so, therefore, they will trust primarily the institutions that they're most comfortable with and discount information that comes from those that they don't.
There's a lot of debate over how to present an inaccurate statement. A headline, if it's politician says blank, and that's a false statement, are you just transmitting the false statement? If you say politician inaccurately says blank, well, are you maybe riding over some of that gray area you were just talking about? How do you, in a headline, in a lead, state that without restating it and stating that it's false?
Well, it's not always possible to get it into the headline, but I hope you could get it into the lead paragraph, the first paragraph or so, to say that this politician is making this claim, but in fact, the truth is X. I think it's important to do those things. The notion that objectivity means that you present all sides in a neutral way presumes that all sides are acting in good faith. And sadly, what we've been learning in the last few years is that is not always the case.
President Trump was in Wisconsin, in Mosinee, Wisconsin, yesterday to campaign for Governor Scott Walker, Senate candidate Leah Vukmir. He said Democrats, he criticized other Democrats around the country. And then he said this about the media. He was talking here about Democrats on immigration in California.
I said the other night, jokingly, probably a Rolls Royce. And one of these people said, he said he's going to give him a Rolls Royce. And he did not say that. The governor never... You can't joke with these people. You can't be even a little sarcastic.
So how do we know when a public figure, President Trump, is joking, engaging in playful hyperbole to even take a statement and say, okay, we need to evaluate the truthfulness of it?
Well, I think the reality is that although certainly there are politicians that will make jokes, we also know that oftentimes saying, I was just kidding, I was just joking, is the response of a bully who's being called on telling a falsehood or uttering a statement that is offensive. I would like to think that as a nation we do retain a sense of humor, and there certainly is a place for humor in politics. But when you're making a factual statement that you know your audience is very likely to take as such, it seems to me you have a responsibility to be clear-cut about what you're doing. And I think President Trump frequently doesn't do that.
We're talking about political fact-checking with Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics at the University of Minnesota. You can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. How do you evaluate the truthfulness of political claims? What do you think the role of the media should be in calling out public figures when they say things that are factually wrong? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about some of the false claims made recently by President Trump and how we can fact check what political candidates, elected officials, advocacy groups, and others are saying. Jane Kirtley is with us, professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. What do you do to evaluate political claims? Do you follow fact checkers? Should the media say, if someone's made a factual misstatement with intent, should a headline, should an article say it was a lie? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now, we'll go to Mark in Webb Lake. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up how does, like, a clinical narcissism fall into this, where they get defensive and to anybody who objects to their point of view.
Mark, thanks for the call. As you said earlier, Jane, you're not a psychologist, so we don't need to evaluate the motivations here. But is there a role for the media in exploring motivations for false statements?
I think there is. I don't think journalists should engage in psychological analysis of someone, but I'm a big believer in reporting what someone says, what someone does, and allowing the reader, or the viewer, or the listener to draw their own conclusions. I mean, from the beginning with President Trump, there's been a lot of sort of backhanded psychology trying to figure out what's motivating him or what's not. You know, I don't know the answer to that. For all I know, this is all being orchestrated by Vladimir Putin, and it really doesn't have anything to do with Trump's psychology. I think what we ought to be doing is saying, here's what he's saying, here's what the reality is, draw your own conclusions from there.
Back to our calls. Thanks, Mark. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think that what Trump is doing is, we should realize, it's historically a true, unfortunately, red, white, and blue aspect of American politics. White racist nationalism existed in the 19th century with the Know Nothing Party that arguably morphed as the Ku Klux Klan. In the 20th century, we have seen Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, the Dixiecrats, the independent George Wallace candidacy for the presidency. And in the 21st century, the bogeyman, for the Know Nothings, it was the Irish and the Italians in the 20th century was African Americans, and now it's Hispanics and Muslims, or people of the Muslim faith. And Trump is simply exploiting this traditional American nativist racist history in our political discussions and policies, and I'll be interested in a guest response.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jane, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think it's certainly correct that we do have a long history in this country of the kind of nativism or nationalism, or however you want to phrase it, that Trump is summoning up as part of his campaign. He didn't begin this. He is simply exploiting it. And I think it's quite true that this is one of the factors that exists in the American psyche. And the key, I think, is to keep pointing it out. I'm a believer in reading history and paying attention to history and looking at parallels in history and pointing them out, because there really isn't anything particularly new under the sun. What we hope will not do is repeat the mistakes of the past.
Jim, thanks for the call. Going out to Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just going to say, to get both a more accurate point of view, I try to sample many different sides of the issue to try and get a more complete picture. I watch not only Fox News or listen to conservative radio, but I also listen to MSNBC and CNN to try and see what the accurate or the actual middle ground is, and from that try to have a more knowledgeable and informed opinion.
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Jane, what do you think of that idea, trying to get a range, even if you don't think of one media outlet as totally reliable, trying to get that range of sources?
I think it's an excellent idea, and the wonderful thing about living when we do now is that it's easier to do that than it ever has been historically before. I guess the one cautionary comment I would make, though, is that one of the things that concerns me is that if you buy the idea, and I'm just doing this as sort of a hypothetical, that Fox or MSNBC or CNN or whoever it is has an editorial agenda, then by that very nature, you are likely to discount even their factual reporting. I think it's really incumbent upon us to force ourselves to draw a distinction between editorial commentary, between pundits, and between reporting. Because, you know, as the old line goes, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not to your own facts. And hopefully, we could get a consensus on the facts, even though we might disagree on what conclusions to draw from them.
In our last few moments, do you think that there's a lot of media out there that is doing a good job of presenting the facts, maybe not perfectly, but in mostly an unbiased way?
I think that they do exist, and I think, again, if you're concentrating on the news pages as opposed to the editorial and commentary part or the straight news reporting, the truth is out there and it can be found. But I would absolutely agree that even putting aside the issue of editorial spin, different news organizations will emphasize different things. And if you want a full smorgasbord, you need to try a lot of different choices.
We'll leave it there for now. Jane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Jane Kirtley is a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota and director of the Silha Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. We talked with her about recent false statements by President Trump and how media can fact check claims by politicians and what media consumers can do, too.